Random House Audio presents Crazy Salad, Some Things About Women, and Scribble Scribble, Notes on the Media by Nora Ephron, read for you by Kate Mazur. Crazy Salad. It's certain that fine women eat a crazy salad with their meat. William Butler Yeats. Preface to Crazy Salad. I began writing a column about women in Esquire magazine in 1972. The column was my idea, and I wanted to do it for a couple of specific self-indulgent reasons and one general reason. Self-indulgent specifics first. I needed an excuse to go to my 10th reunion at Wellesley College, and I was looking for someone to pay my way to the Pillsbury Bake Off. Beyond that, and in general, it seemed clear that American women were going through some changes. I wanted to write about them, and about myself. When I began the column, the women's movement was in a period of great activity, growth, and anger. It is now in a period of consolidation. The same is true for me, and it has something to do with why it has become more and more difficult for me to write about women. Also, I'm afraid, I have run out of things to say. There are 25 articles in this book that glance off and on to the subject of women, and as I go through them, I can think of dozens of others I could have done instead. I don't deal with lesbianism here, and, except peripherally, I don't deal with motherhood. Month by month, I took what interested me most, and so I never wrote about a number of things that interested me somewhat. Pantyhose, tampons, comedians, the Equal Rights Amendment, Fascinating Womanhood, Bella Abzug, The Story of O, The Integration of the Little League. I could go on and on. The point here is simply to say that this book is not intended to be any sort of definitive history of women in the early 1970s. It's just some things I wanted to write about. A few words about breasts. I have to begin with a few words about androgyny. In grammar school, in the 5th and 6th grades, we were all tyrannized by a rigid set of rules that supposedly determined whether we were boys or girls. The episode in Huckleberry Finn, where Huck is disguised as a girl and gives himself away by the way he threads a needle and catches a ball, that kind of thing. We learned that the way you sat, crossed your legs, held a cigarette, and looked at your nails, the way you did these things instinctively was absolute proof of your sex. Now, obviously, most children did not take this literally, but I did. I thought that just one slip, just one incorrect cross of my legs, or a flick of an imaginary cigarette ash, would turn me from whatever I was into the other thing. That would be all it took, really. Even though I was outwardly a girl and had many of the trappings generally associated with girldom, a girl's name, for example, and dresses, my own telephone, an autograph book, I spent the early years of my adolescence absolutely certain that I might, at any point, gum it up. I did not feel at all like a girl. I was boyish. I was athletic, ambitious, outspoken, competitive, noisy, rambunctious. I had scabs on my knees, and my socks slid into my loafers, and I could throw a football. I wanted desperately not to be that way, not to be a mixture of both things, but instead just one, a girl, a definite, indisputable girl, as soft and as pink as a nursery. And nothing would do that for me, I felt, but breasts. I was about 6 months younger than everyone else in my class, and so for about 6 months after it began, for 6 months after my friends had begun to develop, that was the word we used, develop, I was not particularly worried. I would sit in the bathtub and look down at my breasts and know that any day now, any second now, they would start growing like everyone else's. They didn't. I want to buy a bra, I said to my mother one night.
What for? She said.
My mother was really hateful about bras, and by the time my third sister had gotten to the point where she was ready to want one, my mother had worked the whole business into a comedy routine.
Why not use a Band-Aid instead? She would say.
It was a source of great pride to my mother that she had never even had to wear a brassiere until she had her fourth child, and then only because her gynecologist made her. It was incomprehensible to me that anyone could ever be proud of something like that. It was the 1950s, for God's sake. Jane Russell, cashmere sweaters. Couldn't my mother see that?
I am too old to wear an undershirt.
Screaming, weeping, shouting.
Then don't wear an undershirt, said my mother.
But I want to buy a bra.
What for?
I suppose that for most girls, breasts, brassieres, that entire thing, has more trauma, more to do with the coming of adolescence, with becoming a woman, than anything else. Certainly more than getting your period, although that, too, was traumatic, symbolic.
But you could see breasts. They were there. They were visible.
Whereas a girl could claim to have her period for months before she actually got it, and nobody would ever know the difference. Which is exactly what I did. All you had to do was make a great fuss over having enough nickels for the Kotex machine and walk around clutching your stomach and moaning for 3 to 5 days a month about the curse, and you could convince anybody. There is a school of thought somewhere in the women's lib / women's mag / gynecology establishment that claims that menstrual cramps are purely psychological, and I lean toward it. Not that I didn't have them, finally. Agonizing cramps, heating pad cramps, go down to the school nurse and lie on the cot cramps. But unlike any pain I had ever suffered, I adored the pain of cramps, welcomed it, wallowed in it, bragged about it. I can't go. I have cramps. I can't do that. I have cramps. And most of all, gigglingly, blushingly, I can't swim. I have cramps. Nobody ever used the hard court word, menstruation. God, what an awful word. Never that. I have cramps. The morning I first got my period, I went into my mother's bedroom to tell her, and my mother, my utterly hateful about bras mother, burst into tears. It was really a lovely moment, and I remember it so clearly, not just because it was one of the two times I ever saw my mother cry on my account. The other was when I was caught being a 6-year-old kleptomaniac, but also because the incident did not mean to me what it meant to her. Her little girl, her firstborn, had finally become a woman. That was what she was crying about. My reaction to the event, however, was that I might well be a woman in some scientific textbook sense, and could at least stop faking every month and stop wasting all those nickels. But in another sense, in a visible sense, I was as androgynous and as liable to tip over into boyhood as ever. I started with a 28 AA bra. I don't think they made them any smaller in those days, although I gather that now you can buy bras for 5-year-olds that don't have any cups whatsoever in them. Trainer bras, they are called. My first brassiere came from Robinson's department store in Beverly Hills. I went there alone, shaking, positive they would look me over and smile and tell me to come back next year. An actual fitter took me into the dressing room and stood over me while I took off my blouse and tried the first one on. The little puffs stood out on my chest.
"Lean over," said the fitter.
To this day, I'm not sure what fitters in bra departments do except to tell you to lean over. I leaned over, with the fleeting hope that my breasts would miraculously fall out of my body and into the puffs. Nothing. "Don't worry about it," said my friend Libby some months later when things had not improved. "You'll get them after you're married." "What are you talking about?" I said.
"When you get married," Libby explained,
"your husband will touch your breasts and rub them and kiss them and they'll grow." That was the killer. Necking I could deal with. Intercourse, I could deal with.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?